Okay, so we are at the end of Perek Hey. Psukim Chav Chet to Lamed Aleph, sentences 28 to 31. The description of Sisera's mother. And David heard actually a version of this Midrasha in Rosh Hashanah a couple of years ago. It was on this section because it ties into Rosh Hashanah and to Shofar. What we noted already last time is that in Pasuk Chav Chet, in sentence 29, Sisera's mother is described looking out the Eshnav. And I brought you from the Da'at Mikra, Professor Ali Tzur, the idea that an Eshnav is some kind of a luxury. And in general, the description of this space occupied by Sisera's mother is that it's a palace, and she has her matrons with her. Very luxurious compared to Yael's tent. That's his understanding of what the role of the Eshnav is. Here it's meant to convey luxury. Interestingly, Rabbi Yosef Albo takes an opposite position on what this Eshnav is. I know, opposite isn't really the word, but a very different approach to what the Eshnav was. He says the Eshnav is actually about sorcery. This comes in the middle of a discussion. The book Sefer Yikarim, where he talks about this, is a book of philosophy, fundamentally. So it's part of a discussion about the weaknesses of paranormal perception and how a person could try to use paranormal perception and have certain facts that they become aware of but completely misunderstand what it is that they're seeing. And that he uses Sisera's mother as the example. He says, Va'isa Roa, she saw via this Eshnav, Ki Sisera benam mukav harosh al yad isha. She saw that Sisera was struck on the head by a woman. So the wise women, using the Eshnav, saw blood in Sisera's camp. And that the war is done, and that the warriors are all, you know, their blood has all been spilled. And especially Sisera, whose blood was shed via two women, Devore in the war, and then Yael assassinating him. But they completely misunderstood what it was that they were seeing, and hence the description that they give her. So his point is simply to say that the Eshnav is a tool for sorcery, as opposed to Da'at Mikra saying that it's about luxury. So the core of this is in sentences 29 and 30. Right, where her matrons say to her, oh, don't worry about it, and they give her own words back. Tashiv Amareh Allah, they respond to her by saying, Halo Yim Tzu Yechalku Shalal. They're finding spoils. Racham Racham Asayim LaRosh Gever. And this is the coarsest of the coarse. Racham Racham is a womb. There's a pluralization here. Racham Asayim would be two. So Racham Racham Asayim LaRosh Gever for each man. Shlal Tzivaim LaSisra. And spoils of colored material for Sisera, shlal tzevaim rikma, colored material rikma is embroidery, tzeva rikma sayim litzavrei shalal, this dyed embroidery around the necks, of the despoilers, so the people who took the spoils. It doesn't read well grammatically because it's poetry, but. That's the description of how she becomes comforted, is with this description of Sisera and his man, Sisera, her son, involved in rape and in pillaging. Ralbag notes this in number 3 when he gives you his lessons that you're supposed to learn from this section. He says, Hashmi, the 8th lesson, hu lefarsim genus ha'umos ha'im, is to publicize just how disgraceful these nations are, v'hiyosim prutzim ba'arayot, that they were completely wanton and immoral. Uzeh dima im Sisera besipur hatzlacha Sisera racham rachmasayim l'rosh gaber. And so, you know, that's what you see Sisera's mother talking about to illustrate her son's success. And this goes back to a theme that we started the story with when we talked about Canaan as the enemy of the Jews and the opposition between Canaan and the Jews. We are meant to be their replacements, right? We've talked about this before. you know, the ideal would have been to make them gerei toshav, to teach them the seven mitzvahs, and then they accept those. But failing that, you have to replace them. And their immorality is already seen in the Chumash. We have this pasuk, Maaseh Eretz Mitzrayim, Maaseh Eretz Canaan. Don't emulate Egypt and don't emulate Canaan. I brought you the Sifra on it in source number 4, which says that no nation was more degenerate than Canaan. So that's the enemy presented to us. When we slip and become Canaan-like, then they are brought to attack us and remind us of what we've become. And the last pasuk in this poem, Kein yovdu kol eivecha Hashem, so should all of your enemies be destroyed, God, ba'ohavav, and those who love God, kitzeis Hashemesh begvuraso, they should emerge like the sun in its strength. Most commentators understand that to mean that those who love God should emerge like the sun in its strength. But Abarbanel reads Rashi to read it as ohavav, those who love Sisra. Those who love Sisra should be punished like the sun emerging in its strength. That's like Abarbanel reads Rashi. Batishkot ha'aretz arbeim shana, and the land was silent for 40 years, which Ralbag Abarbanel assume includes the 20 years that they suffered under Canaan. So it's 40, but with a discount. It's actually 20.
Sorry, what was the explanation of Vav of Sisra?
Right. So the standard read is those who love God, because the pasuk said, "So shall be destroyed all of your enemies, God, and right. those who love God." Dot dot dot. That's the standard read. However, it's grammatically a little bit off because you're addressing God. Right? Kol oivecha Hashem. And ohavav is third person. Those who love him. So Abarbanel reads Rashi to say, those who love him is about Sisra. Those who love Sisra will be punished, like with the force that the sun has when it emerges. Which is an idea you find elsewhere in Tanakh, the image of punishment with the heat of the sun, God bringing the sun out. That's something that you see elsewhere. So, the other way to read it.
Where did this, unless I'm mixing up my stories, but where did this become the episode that we get taught when we're a little kid not to gloat over the death of our enemies? Was that this, or is that another?
No, this is not brought. We're gloating. We're good. They were happily gloating.
But is there another episode where someone's mother is wailing for her now dead, who's an enemy of ours, but we say that.
So this does get quoted in what I think where you're going is the following. I wasn't there yet, but now we're getting there anyway. The usual source for not gloating is the question of at the sea, the Malachim can't sing when the Egyptians drown. We are able to sing because we are the ones who were saved, but the Malachim are not allowed to. It's not for them to, because it wasn't them being saved, and then it's just destruction of Hashem's handiwork. But what's interesting here, and what will lead us towards what you're talking about, is the verb used in the beginning here to describe Sisra's mother's cries. It says Vatia Bev. That is a loaded word. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 5, literally we translate it as, and she wailed. So the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah is talking about shofar blowing. Ksiv, the Torah says, Yom Tiru'ah Yehiyah Lachem. Let me take a step back actually before this Gemara. The Torah uses two words to describe the sounds of the shofar. One is Tikiah, Utkatem, right? Or Titku. So words like that, tekiah, and it assumes that we know what a tekiah is. It's a straight sound. That's a given. It also uses the term tiruah. Once it says utkatem tiruah, vahareyotem b'chatzotzerot, and tiruah, the Gemara isn't sure what a tiruah actually refers to. It's some type of cry. That we know. It's some type of cry. So that's what they're trying to explain here, is what is a tru'ah. So the Torah says, Yom tru'ah yehiyah lachem, it shall be a day of tru'ah for you, umetargaminan, and we render that in the Aramaic commentary as Yom yevava yehelachon. The word tru'ah in Aramaic is yevava. Okay, what's a yevava? Uchsiv be'enei de Sisra. Well, it says regarding Sisra's mother, ba'ana halo nishkafa, batia beiv em Sisra, that she looked out the window, right, and she did yivava. So that tells me that whatever trua is, it's what Sisra's mother was doing. And the Gemara says there are two different views. Mar sabar genuche ganach, umar sabar yulule yalil. One thought that it's a groaning type of a cry, and the other one thought it's a wailing type of a cry. And the idea is either it is a shivarim, right, the groan type of a cry, or it's more of the staccato terua type of a cry, when someone like can't catch their breath. So what the Gemara says is that the cry of Sisra's mother becomes the basis of trying of how we blow the terua. I should. This is probably a good spot to insert. Rav Hai Gaon has a well known responsum on this topic because he was asked, how could the Gemara not know what a terua is? Were they not blowing the terua every single year? And therefore, the answer is whatever we did last year is what a terua is. Why did they not know? And especially because the way it's framed in the Gemara is actually that one of the Amoraim, one of the sages of the Gemara's time, was the one who created the system that we have today, in which we blow Shvarim, and we blow Trua, and we blow Shvarim Trua, which seems to imply that before that, there was confusion in different communities. They were blowing different things, and he unified everybody and said, everybody just blow all the possible sounds, and we'll have 100 sounds, and everything will be fine. But then the question is, again, why did they need that? At what point did things get split up? So Rav Hai Gaon said, you're misunderstanding the way this works. Trua just means a crying sound. That's all it means. It's legitimate for the crying sound to be like a shvarim. It's legitimate for the crying sound to be like a trua. It's legitimate for the crying sound to be a shvarim trua. All of those are legitimate representations of crying. What the Gemara, and I think it's Rav Huna there in the Gemara, it's Rabbi Avo. What Rabbi Avo was concerned about in the days of the Gemara was the appearance that there are different Torahs. Like this community blows shofar this way, this community blows shofar this way, this one blows shofar this way. It looks like we're like practicing a different religion. You know, on Rosh Hashanah, of all days, we should all be doing the same thing. And therefore, he said, we're going to institute from now on, everybody blows Shvarim Trua and Shvarim Trua. So that everybody's doing the same thing. But not that it was wrong before that for a community to do only one of those sounds. Now it's wrong, because Rabbi Avo said, this is what you're supposed to do. But until then, it was fine that everyone was doing their own thing. That's the idea. That's Rav Hai Gaon's tshuva. Yeah, it's a very important tshuva because it includes within it his response to the Karaites. He talks about in this tshuva, it's fascinating. He talks about the question of how you determine halacha. And he says the most basic form of halacha is what do Jews do? That's the most basic form of halacha. Your first question is, what do Jews do? And then after that, you can go into, well, the Pasuk says this, and the Gemara says this, and whatever it is, but your first evaluation of what is legitimate halacha is, what do Jews do? Wow. And it's a very interesting statement, and it carried a lot of heft, because Rav Hai Gaon was really the last of the great and powerful Gaonim. He was already the end. He's the last generation also. Already 100 years before him, things were starting to deteriorate in the whole Gaonic system. His father was I think, Rav Shrira Gaon, who also was very powerful. But it was deteriorating by his day, and what he said carries a lot of weight in a lot of areas. So, going back to this though, and this Gemara, that's our connection of Sisra's mother with blowing shofar. The Aruch, Rabbi Nassan Bal HaAruch, added. Rabbi Nassan Bal HaAruch is also a very important figure. He's from the 10th century to the 11th century, I believe. And he is one of the very first of the Rishonim. I didn't bring him on the sheet. He's one of the first of the Rishonim, meaning post-Gaonim. He wrote a dictionary, but in the classic dictionary style. You remember, you're old enough to have used dictionaries. How the dictionary would have like the word, the definition, and then like uses of the word.
Yeah.
So Rabbi Nassan Bal HaAruch wrote this work called the Aruch, which is essentially an Aramaic dictionary. in which he uses passages from the Gemara as his examples of use of the word, and he explains them. And so, very often, we can get from the way he explains the Gemara, not only a definition of a word, but also an understanding of how to read the Gemara itself. Wow. So it's a very valuable book. It's been republished in recent years in different forms.
Is that the Aruch HaShulchan? No.
No, different thing, yeah. Just the Aruch. That's it. So the Aruch and others in early Ashkenaz say to blow 100 shofar blasts on Rosh Hashanah because Sisera's mother cried for him 100 times. That's the other.
That must be where I got it from. It must be in the Masor somewhere that.
Yeah, for
a
sure.
Comment about how we're not supposed to gloat because we feel bad for her even though he was an evil person.
Right, so that's the question here. But before we get to that, just to explain the 100, meaning you could satisfy all the different versions of Trua, meaning the Shvarim Trua, and the Trua. You could satisfy that with just 30 shofar blasts. That's what we do. Meaning when we first make the brachas on shofar, when we blow the shofar before Musaf, we do 30 blasts and we've got everything possible in there. Because from the Torah, you only have 9 shofar blasts. In the Torah itself, based on the uses of the word Tkia and Trua in the Torah, we have 9 blasts. Tkia, Trua, Tkia 3 times. However, once that becomes 3 sets of Tkia Shvarim Tkia, 3 sets of Tkia Terua Tkia, so it's 9 plus 9, and then 3 sets of Tkia Shvarim Terua Tkia, and each one of those is really considered 4, Tkia Shvarim Terua Tkia, so it's 9, so it's 3 times 4 is 12, so 18 plus 12 is 30. That would be, so with 30, when you by throwing 30 blasts, you get 3 sets of each kind, which is all you need. But we do it once in the beginning. And then we do it again during Shemona Esrei, because it's really supposed to be with the brachos of Musaf Shemona Esrei, with Malchios, Zichronos, Shofar. Some shuls will do it in the silent Shemona Esrei, some shuls will do it in the repetition of the Shemona Esrei. But that's your second set of 30. That only brings you to 60. Why are we doing 40 more after Musaf? And the answer is, this is a minhag. This is a custom of doing 100, and the Aruch and others from 800-900 years ago said we're doing it in order to match Sisera's mother who cried 100 times. It is not clear how we know that she cried 100 times. The Pasuk did not say that. There are gematrias that people use in order to try to, you know, figure out where the hint is that it was 100. But the question that you have to ask is, and this was from the drasha that I gave a couple of years ago. Why would we invoke the image of Sisera's mother with shofar? I mean, she's awful. But you thought her son was bad, and then you look at her, and it's staggering. I mean, she is a very good contrast with Devorah and Yael, right? This is a polemic regarding Canaanite women. Versus ours. Devorah and Yael are wonderful and they're brave and all that, and she's just brutal. But why would you invoke her when you're blowing shofar? So the Sefer HaTodah, Rabbi Leo Kitov, suggests that we're not really looking at her villainy, you know, when she cries in her cruelty, but rather we weep with humanity at shofar. It's almost like it's a contrast. She cried cruelly, and we are going to cry humanely. Rabbi Aaron Goldscheider suggested a different answer, which goes towards what Ori was saying, which is that at the end of the day, she's a bereaved parent, and therefore we invoke her. My problem with that answer is we've got other bereaved parents in Tanakh. You didn't need to pick this one. I mean, this is not the one you needed to invoke. Rav Soloveitchik argued that it's because she saw that her whole life was wrong in this instant. Like, she's looking out the window and realizes that everything she's, you know, represented is just wrong. And you want to invoke that at the time of shofar. But I thought that the answer is, and I saw an idea like this from Rav Yehuda Amital, is that it's because she, even this person who is so cruel, right, and who is so inhuman, really, is able to crack. Yeah, you just have to find the right point, and she cracks. You know, she's crying about her son, and so the idea for us at the time of shofar is also it's the moment of our sincerity. It's the moment when you look past all the layers that obscure the person's true nature.
Given the narcissists that I've known in my life,
yes,
they tend to, when they're crying about other people, they're really not crying about them. They're crying about themselves. Mm-hmm. And, oh, what does this mean for me? And to my mind, this is just more of the same. Like, I don't...
You feel no sympathy?
None.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's the comments that are made seem to...
Well, that's the matrix. That's not her.
No. True. You're right. There's nothing in here that would indicate that perhaps she didn't do an about face, but
yeah.
I don't see it.
Okay. I feel no great obligation to redeem her.
With current events, you sometimes see the enemy who's done so terrible things to our people, and then once in a while you see on the television their mother's crying.
Yeah.
And it's hard to have sympathy.
So the themes that you see, wrapping up everything that we've seen in the last couple of prakim, right, are number one, that leadership is defined not by gender but by qualities, right? So like Devorah and Yael have it. Sisera does not have it, right? He runs the wrong way. Barak seems to be a little challenged in this area as well. But not all women are good either, because they are presented with Sisera's mother. This is not a story of double X chromosome good, XY bad. It's just not, because Sisera's mother is the proof that it's not so. Another theme here, God acts in our behalf miraculously, right? Like seen in this war. The need for loyalty to others. Right, Hever helps us out. There are some Shvatim who rallied with us. The Kananim rallied on their side. The whole volunteering theme, nature, you know, Yael, all of the volunteers. The opposition we noted at the end between Canaan's pursuit of luxury and pleasure versus Spartan Devorah, who, you know, judges under a date palm, and Yael in her tent. All of these are themes in these prakim. Okay, I'm ready for the next.
Okay,
yeah,
just yeah. One question on this: the last line, that is still part of Orishir.
So it appears, okay. Except the last part because it can't be. But Tishkodar Sabim Shana is
still in that verse. And why do you have to interpret that as 20 years under Kanani rule, 20 years
right
after?
So the ones who I quoted to say that are Ralbag and Abarbanel. Ralbag and Abarbanel spend an unduly large amount of time trying to make all of the years work between Yitzias Mitzrayim and when the Beis HaMikdash is built. It's a big problem trying to get everything squared away because there are certain periods which are vague. So, best example of this is in Shmuel Aleph. Oh, right, I still have some here. The Shmuel Aleph in, I think it's Perek Zion, where we're told that the Plishtim had sent back the Aron, and then we're told that there's a 20-year period. And from the Pesukim, it sounds like after this 20-year period, the Jews do tshuva, and Shmuel does a big sort of revival event, and everybody is loyal to God. And the problem is, when was Shmuel's event? Was it really at the end of the 20 years? Was it during the 20 years? There are problems of logic. There are problems with making it fit with the idea that Shmuel died at the age of 52, which is not found in the Psukim in any clear way. It's a Medrash. And the Medrash is based on things. It's not made up. But it's not the only way to read the data. And so Ralbag and Abarbanel spend a lot of time trying to figure all of this out. If you want, like, to see, you know, this sort of thing in depth, look at either Ralbag and Abarbanel on Shmuel Aleph Perek Zion, or when we get to Yiftach, we'll see it also, because Yiftach is recruited to fight the war against Amon. And as part of that, there's an exchange of letters between Amon and Yiftach in which the claim is made that we had come into Israel 300 years earlier. And so Rabag says, wait, I need to get my calculator out and figure out how this was 300 years. But that's why they say it. It's not because of any internal logic here. It's about the bigger picture of getting everything to fit. One of the interesting pieces of that is the debate which we began Sefer Shoftim with of, are these all the Shoftim, or are we just getting certain figures, but there were other Shoftim, and are these Shoftim consecutive, or are there gaps in between them? While Bagan and Barbanel are assuming that all the years we're given are all the years there are. There are no breaks, and everything is one after the other after the other. And they use that to try to figure the chronology. Okay. So, I'm going to start a new recording for the next paragraph.